So Mishpatim begins. Last week we concluded with the giving of the Torah, the Aseres HaDibros. That was towards the end of last week's parsha. That will be important to keep the chronological order as to how things are presented to us. That really was an inaccurate statement, because the Torah does not necessarily always present things in a chronological order, but it's important to keep track of how the Torah presents this information. That's going to play a central role in the piece that we will study this afternoon. The piece that I'd like to study is the beginning of chapter 24. So just, you'll keep a finger on that for a moment. Chapter 24 begins on page 440. I'm sorry, there are no seats left.
Oh, there are. That's a good sign for you.
This is a good sign for me. There must be something. I don't know. Okay, so the piece that I'd like to study is at the very end of the parsha, page 440. You'll see the parsha ends on the following page, 442. This is really towards the end. Everything which takes place in the beginning, which means running all the way from page 416, which is where the parsha begins, at the beginning of chapter 21. So chapters 21, 22, 23, those three full chapters are a series of laws. It's three chapters worth. It's enough to grind anybody to a halt if you're just reading through it. It's pretty, if I were to be allowed to, would use law. It's dry laws. It's just a bunch of, this one beats up that one, he pays this amount. This one's cow eats this one, he pays that amount. If he kills it with his horn, he kills it with his feet. It's just a series of laws of animal laws. We discussed the beginning of the parasha has the law of a Jewish slave, which is certainly of interest, of a female Jewish slave, what we punish. I'm just flipping through the headings of just the topics that are run through, because again, this will be important for for where we'll pick up the story, what's been discussed since the Ten Commandments are at the end of last week's parasha, and then we end up with this whole series of laws that mention the slaves, manslaughter, what's the law if you kill a slave, what's the law if you inflict some type of bodily injury on somebody else. What if my animal causes death? What if I dig a pit? What if my animal damages your property? What if somebody steals life? A whole series of laws. Each one of these verses, by the way, this is always fascinating in yeshiva, many of these verses, for just one or two of the verses, has an entire tractate dedicated to going through those laws. So, for example, there are about nine verses which discuss the laws of animals inflicting damage, whether or not the animal does it with its horn, with its feet, whether or not it eats. About nine verses in the entire. It's about 80 pages in the Talmud discussing those nine verses, working through all the various possibilities of how we understand those verses. So it's like that. But so the whole, this is our first injection, so to speak, of the law as the Torah goes on. And then we get to chapter 24, which is where we are going to study, and I will open up our discussion of chapter 24, the very first, and the part that's going to run us, we're going to take this theme that I'm about to say and run it through the entire, hopefully we'll get through the first 12 verses. There is a dispute between Rashi and the Ramban when these verses took place. That is going to set the context for what we are about to study. Chronologically speaking in the Torah, it's clear. The order would be, we have the giving of the Torah, Ten Commandments, Moshe goes up to Har Sinai, comes back down, tells us the Ten Commandments. Then we would have three chapters worth of laws, which would be a significant amount of time, effort, energy, and just body information. And then we have the verses that we're about to study. That's the chronological order. And Rashi is in fact going to say that that is incorrect as far as the way that it took place. The verses that we are about to study actually took place before the giving of the Torah. We'll have to learn about why they are here. But this preceded those three chapters of laws and the giving of the Torah. This took place way before. And the Ramban is going to be of the opinion that everything that we're reading is as it is presented. He does not see a strong enough reason to say that the Torah is out of order. I'll add one more parenthetical statement about that topic. There are several instances in the Torah where it is clear that the Torah is out of order. That is indisputable. How do we know that it's indisputable, right? Not undisputable. How do we know that it is indisputable that the Torah is out of order? For example, in the beginning of the book of Numbers, the book of Bamidbar, the opening chapter of the book of Bamidbar is, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, is this, I think it's the second month of the second year of the Jews' journey in the desert. And nine chapters later, the Torah records something which took place in the first month of the second year. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist. If the events, it's recorded out of order. The first chapter starts with the second month, and nine chapters later, the Torah describes something which took place in the first month. So the principle that the Torah does not go in chronological order is not able to be disputed. Right. So the question is, how many flashbacks do we have? So the dispute amongst the commentators is, how strong a reason do I need to come up with to say that a particular episode is or is not out of order? Sometimes it's obvious when the Torah lists the date that it's recording, it's out of order. What happens when the Torah doesn't say that it's out of order? So here you have numerous disputes amongst the commentators. Rashi and the Ramban have several of these disputes, whether or not Rashi is much quicker to say, yeah, it's out of order, doesn't seem to be a little bit difficult in the text, no problem. Just move it a little bit earlier, cut and paste, took place earlier, and I'll give some reason why. Ramban is much more true to the text. He feels you need a really strong reason to say that the Torah is out of order. He's willing to say it. And because he holds that you need to have a much stronger reason, more often than not, he will say, as it was presented to us, is the way that it took place, and he will therefore explain it as follows. Here is going to be one of their disputes, and we'll see that this dispute will take us through these 12 verses, these 12 psukim as we go through. They're obviously very colored as to whether or not the verses we're about to read took place before the Torah was given, before three chapters worth of laws were given, or whether or not this is being discussed after we've had all of these laws and this massive episode of the giving of the Torah and the Ten Commandments being brought down. That's a pretty big event in Jewish history. So whether or not, as we approach these verses, it happened before or after, will obviously color as we run through the verses and try to understand what it is that we are being told. Is that enough of the background? I usually try to limit it to less than 25 minutes of background before we actually get started studying. I think I have been successful this week. Let us move forward. I feel like you're not part of us.
I am. I'm fine.
Okay. Chapter 24, Perek Chof Dalet, says the Torah as follows, V'el Moshe Omar, page 440. So unto Moshe Hashem says, Alei El Hashem, go up to Hashem. So clearly Moshe is at the bottom of the mountain right now. Which mountain are we talking about? Obviously Har Sinai. Moshe is now situated at the bottom of the mountain. Hashem gives him just one more, I told you I was finished with my background. Just one more sentence. I just want you to understand, you should see that directly the verses before we are up to are still discussing the laws, various laws. The three pilgrimage festivals are discussed on page 437. And then the very last discussion that we have over here is a prohibition against idolatry. Those are the very last couple of verses which are discussed in the end of chapter 23, certain blessings that will be given to the Jewish people when they settle the land of Israel, the prohibition against idolatry is restated, and then we go into what we're about to read. So it's really right following a lot of series of the three chapters of the laws, a prohibition against idolatry, and now Moshe is situated at the bottom of the mountain, says Hashem, Alei El Hashem, rise up, go up to Hashem, climb up the mountain, Atah ve'Aharon, Nadav ve'Avihu. You and Aharon, you and your brother Aharon, Aharon's two sons, Nadav and Avihu, they will also go up with you. The Shivim Mizikne Yisrael, and 70 of the elders of Israel, we found throughout, even beginning already in the times when the Jews were still in Egypt, they had this body of leadership, the 70 elders, who were the leaders of the Jewish people. So Hashem tells Moshe, he, his brother Aharon, Aharon's two sons, Nadav and Avihu, and then the 70, so a party of 74 go up to the mountain, v'hishtachavisem merachok, and you will bow down and prostrate yourselves from a distance. So you will not go up, all of you, all the way up the mountain, but you, 74, the 70 elders, you and Aaron, the two sons, will distance yourself from the people and begin your ascent up the mountain. When did this take place? When is this command being given? So if you look at Rashi, if you want to read it inside, I'll read and translate. It's four lines down on the first column. Parsha zu ne'emra kodem aseres adibros. This discussion, this command for Moshe to rise up, and we'll see what then is communicated between Hashem and Moshe. Everything that's about to take place happened days earlier, before the giving of the Torah. Rashi says it was actually on the 4th of Sivan. Moshe receives the Torah. It's a dispute in the Talmud whether or not he received the Torah on the 6th of Sivan or on the 7th of Sivan. Everybody agrees it was on a Shabbos. There was a dispute exactly which date of the month it was on. Nonetheless, says Rashi, this entire parsha, this entire series of psukim, was said beforehand. So in our mind, as we read through these verses, says Rashi, this is before the Ten Commandments have been given. This is before we've received these three chapters of laws. The Ramban here argues, and we'll trace the Ramban's opinion as we go through the verses. The Ramban says, I don't see any reason to say that the Torah is out of order over here. And the Ramban understands that this is exactly in the order that we have read it. We've received the Ten Commandments, we've received three chapters of laws in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim, and now there's a new commandment after all of that has been given over to the Jewish people. Again, Hashem says, I want you and Aharon, your two sons, and the 70 elders to ascend up the mountains. Let us continue. Pasuk Beis, V'nigash Moshe Levado El Hashem. However, Moshe alone will make the final ascent up the mountain. Vehem lo yigashu. So he will be accompanied out of the camp with this large entourage of his brother and the two nephews and the 70 elders. But Moshe alone will then ascend all the way up the mountain. Vehaam lo ya'alu imo. The rest of the nation will not approach with him. And this is, of course, because of the special intimate relationship between Moshe and Hashem. When Hashem communicates with Moshe, it is with Moshe alone. He will be escorted up. All people of honor are given an escort. We find that in numerous places in the Torah. Abraham, when he saddled up his donkey to sacrifice his son Yitzchak, had his two other boys with him. Rashi comments over there, that was the way of an Adam Choshev, the way of an important person, is that he would be accompanied in his travels. So Moshe, so to speak, escorted by Aharon and his two nephews and the 70 elders, but he alone climbs up the mountain. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Vayavo Moshe. Moshe then came. So apparently, where did he come from? So he's been told to go up. Seems like he's been up there. He then comes. Vayisaper lo'om eis kol divrei Hashem. And he then tells the people all of the words of Hashem. Ve'eis kol hamishpatim. And all of the ordinances, all the laws. Now the word mishpatim is obviously familiar to us from, that's the name of the parsha, Elu hamishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. These are the laws that you shall place before the people. We have that exact same phrase over here. So Hashem, Moshe then tells the people, Kol divrei Hashem, all the words of Hashem, Eis kol hamishpatim, and all of the laws. That's what's been now been taught from Moshe to the people. Vayaan kol ha'om kol echad, and all the people answer with a singular voice, with one voice they say together, Vayomru kol hadvarim asher diber Hashem na'aseh, all of that which Hashem has said, we will do. So I ask you, what did Moshe teach the Jewish people at this point? So, with what I already told you, between Rashi and the Ramban, you already have your hands tied behind your back in terms of what you can answer. If you learn like Rashi, when did this whole event take place? Before the giving of the Torah. So when the Torah tells us that Moshe taught the Jewish people all the words of Hashem and all of the laws, what was he teaching them? So Rashi's bothered by this question because it can't be the most obvious response, which would be the Ten Commandments and the last three chapters of law. It hasn't happened yet. This is 3 or 4 days before that. So Rashi is aware of this problem, and Rashi comments as follows. Rashi is in Pasuk Gimel. Vayavo Moshe vayisaper lo'am bo bayom. Moshe told the people on that day, before going up, what did he teach them? As kol divrei Hashem, Rashi says, mitzvahs prisho v'hagvola. What's the reference to all the words of Hashem? That Hashem, now we did not learn this together, we didn't study this last week, but before, in the 3 days of preparation that the Jewish people were given to go up, before they were given the Torah, they were given a certain set of guidelines as to how they were supposed to prepare themselves. One was not to touch the mountain. They were supposed to surround it, but not go up or ascend or touch even the mountain. And they were all to separate from their wives. They were to clean their clothing. There was a certain series of preparations that they needed to go through. So Rashi interprets, what does this verse mean when Moshe told over to the Jewish people all the words of Hashem? All the words of Hashem that they needed to know in terms of preparing to be given the Torah. The mitzvah of Prisha, the mitzvah of separating from their wives, and the mitzvah of not going on to the mountain. What about the phrase where the Torah says that Moshe taught all the Jewish people all of the laws? What's the laws referring to? Says Rashi, Sheva mitzvos shenitztavu b'nei Noach. the seven Noahide laws. This, with Jewish people, have had a tradition since
Noah.
It's correct. It's actually not correct. I threw that out there, assuming you would say that. Somebody would say that. The Gemara, interestingly, learns that it wasn't necessarily Noah who received all the laws. Some were given already before Noah to Adam. Some were given after Noah to Avram or son. But they're referred to as the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noah, the seven Noahide laws. Nonetheless, wherever they're derived from, and that could be another topic for another class. So Rashi interprets, what's Moshe teaching the Jewish people? This event is always taking place before the Torah was given. So what he taught the Jewish people were the seven Noahide laws. Anybody know what they are, by the way?
One died, three courts, don't steal, don't murder, adultery.
So it's the three big ones, the three major prohibitions that the Jewish people are obligated to give up their own life for, which are adulterous relationships, idol worship, and murder. Those three, which a Jew, if he's faced with the choice of either giving up his life or violating one of those, he needs to give up his life rather than violate those. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, kill that person, or I'll kill you, so you do whatever you want, but I'm not doing it. So those three are part of the seven, and then Aleph is Gimel Dalet. Aleph is Avram and Achai, eating from an animal that has not yet been killed. They don't have to shech, they don't have to ritually slaughter an animal, but the animal, the meat from which a non-Jew eats has to be already a dead animal before they eat it. Beis is to curse God, Beiraches Hashem. Gimel is Gezel, stealing. And Dalet is Dinim, it's the set of courts of law. You have to have a system of law set up. Those are the seven Noahide laws. So Rashi learned that's what Moshe is teaching them. Now this is important. We're about to hear the famous phrase we're getting to soon of Na'aseh V'Nishma. So they were taught something before they said that. According to Rashi, what were they taught? The seven Noahide laws. And Rashi adds three others. Kibun Av V'Eim. Sorry, four others. Shabbos, Rashi writes. The law of Shabbos. Kibun Av V'Eim. The mitzvah of honoring one's parents. Pora Aduma, and the law of the red heifer, the red cow, that when a person becomes ritually impure, he comes into contact with a dead body, so his ritual purification process included the slaughtering of a red cow, and then its ashes were burnt and mixed with some water, and it was sprinkled on him on the third day, on the seventh day. It's a whole process how it worked. But those laws, where did they get these three laws from? Rashi says when the Jews got to Mara, which was, I forget, either the first or the second stop after the exodus from Egypt, they got to Marah, where the waters were bitter. They had no waters to drink, and Hashem did a miraculous event. They threw a stick into the water. The water turned sweet. This event was recorded a couple weeks ago. And there, the Torah says, Hashem taught the Jewish people a couple laws. Which laws? Rashi holds the laws that they were taught were those three. Shabbos, Paraduma, Kibbut Ava'im. Now, not for today, but for question for thought. If you were in your second step following the exodus of Egypt and you were going to teach the Jewish people three laws, any three, but just three, there's a little teaser, so to speak, because they're going to be getting the Torah in another 7 weeks, but they're not there yet. But you wanted to give them something to chew on. Which three would you give them? Now, you don't have to answer right now, and there's no right or wrong answer. I mean, there's a right answer because God apparently chose His three, but these are an interesting three. These are the three that the Jewish people were given. They were given Shabbos. I think that would be the easiest to explain why the Jewish people would be given Shabbos. That, I think, what we could wrap. Yeah, that's an important one. That's the foundation of our belief system that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. That one I think I could go for. Kibbut Av V'Eim, important, yes. It makes it to the Aseres HaDibros. It's number 5 on the list of the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments. Would it be the first three? Interesting. Rashi says not that way. I think there are various opinions as to what the three were. Rashi does not believe it is Rosh Chodesh. And then the third, Paraduma. The laws of the red cow, that when you become ritually impure, that's in your top three. Fascinating. So there is much discussion. What is it about these three? Is it a combination of the lessons learned of the three or each three? Whatever. Not for our topic for today, but Rashi holds those are the three mitzvahs which were given in Mara in the first or second stop outside of the land of Egypt. So for a grand total of 10 mitzvahs. So according to Rashi, where is this episode taking place? Before the giving of the Torah, Moshe, before ascending the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments, goes over to the Jewish people and teaches them Ten Commandments, which they already knew already. This is not the first time they've been taught that. This is one of the Ramban's problems with Rashi's interpretation. These ten things which are being taught, they knew already. The seven Noahide laws, they've known that for a long time. These three is a review of what they already learned in Mara. Nonetheless, Rashi's interpretation of what's going on here in the Torah is before Moshe ascends the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments and the rest of the Torah, he teaches the Jewish people these ten laws. Let's read one more verse and then we'll go back to the Ramban's approach. What do the Jewish people say upon hearing these things? Kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh. Whatever Hashem says, we will obey. Vayichtov Moshe, verse 4, Pasuk Dalet. Vayichtov Moshe es kol divrei Hashem. Moshe then writes down all the words of Hashem. What did he write down? What does Moshe write down? He's not yet gone up the mountain. What did Moshe write down? Says Rashi, it's on the top of your second column, Mi bereshis ve'ad matan Torah. Moshe wrote down at this point everything which took place from the beginning of Bereshis until where they were up to historically speaking. So that's what was written in this verse. So the Jewish people had a written copy before the Aseres Hadibros were given. Before Moshe has ascended up the mountain and comes back down with his two tablets and the Ten Commandments and then the rest of the Torah which he spends 40 years teaching, before then they had a scroll which contained in it from Bereshis Baro Elohim, in the beginning Hashem created, until that point in history. All of Sefer Bereshis, all the episodes with the brothers, with Avram, with Yitzchak, with Yaakov, down to Mitzrayim, they had up to Parshas Mishpatim, through Parshas Yisro, Shmos, Va'era, Bo, Vishalch, all of those Parshas they had, up to this point. Did you know that? Before Moshe comes down with Aseres Hadibros, they already had all that. That's how Rashi learns, because the verse says, Vayichtoiv Moshe es kol divrei Hashem. What did he write? Says Rashi, he wrote down everything until that point. We had a copy of the Torah up to that point. Now, I want to make mention, before you ask me a question, which I'm sure is going to be a bomb question that I'm not going to be able to answer, let me just throw out one more point. There's a dispute in the Talmud whether or not the Torah was given piecemeal, meaning each time a law was learnt, it was transcribed by Moshe in the words that we have now in the Torah, but it was given to the Jewish people a little bit at a time. They had a written copy of this, a written copy of that, and then at the end of the 40 years it was put all together. Or whether or not it was given orally as they went along, but it was given in a written form only as one long scroll at the very end. The dispute in the Talmud. So the Maral discusses over here how this fits in with that dispute. How Rashi's comment over here that Moshe wrote down at this point, again in Rashi's interpretation, this is before Moshe even went up to the mountain to get the Torah for the first time, how we already have written down a copy of the Torah from Bereshis until this point. Fascinating comment in Rashi. Let me just finish, and Rashi also adds, V'kos of mitzvah shenitztovu b'mara. And he wrote down those three mitzvahs which they had been taught already in Mara. So before Moshe goes up, the Jewish people have a scroll from Bereshis until that point, and three mitzvahs. The mitzvah of Shabbos, the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Va'Em, and the mitzvah of Parah Adumah. Shabbos, honoring one's parents, and the laws of the red cow. Those are all written in this scroll from Bereshis until Matan Torah. I didn't make this up. It's right here in Rashi. Yes, Elaine.
Okay, so you're saying Moshe wrote this part of the Torah?
Divinely inspired, it is. He wrote what we have today, but yes, he wrote down, it's called Divrei Hashem, the words of Hashem, and they had a scroll with all of the Torahs. We have it written down from Bereshis until this point in history. In the original, as we have it.
All of this in one night?
Yeah. I don't know that, unless it seems that way. I'm just saying that answer I don't know for sure. Seems from the text and from Rashi that, yeah, at this point he wrote it all down. It doesn't say that he gave over that which he's been keeping a record of. It says, and he wrote it down. So that's what it would sound like.
Didn't he write 12 copies before he died?
Yeah, that's, we've got 40 years to do that. We're now, we're less than 7 weeks from the Exodus. Remember, we celebrate Shavuos, which is the giving of the Torah, is exactly 7 weeks from the Exodus of Egypt. So we're still right at about 7 weeks. We're, you know, 6 weeks, 6.5 weeks. And he completed that. That's 40 years from then. So we've still got quite a ways to do that. Okay, so far so good?
Just to be absolutely clear, what is it that caused Rashi to... What was his... Is it that it says he wrote down all the words of Hashem, and so that's the issue? Why he had to say it comes before?
I'm not sure what forced him. The Maral does address. The Ramban argues on Rashi. Let me get back to your... Let me finish up the other side of the picture. The Ramban argues on all of this that I just said over from Rashi. Because the Ramban holds this event is taking place as it's recorded, chronologically speaking, after the giving of the Torah. Not only is this taking place after the giving of the Torah that there's a second command for Moshe to climb up the mountain, this is after 3 chapters worth of laws. We have a lot of laws on record at this point. Enough to keep a yeshiva guy busy for 4 or 5 years in these first 3 chapters of Mishpatim. So when the Ramban reads verse 3, and it says, Moshe came and he told over to the people all the words of Hashem and all of the Mishpatim, what do you suppose the Ramban thinks that's referring to? All of the words of Hashem and the Ten Commandments and all of the Mishpatim that we've just read in Parshas Mishpatim. The Parsha opened up with the words, these are the laws that Hashem put before the Jewish people. So when the verse at the end of the Parsha says, and Moshe taught over to the Jewish people all of the laws, that's what he taught them. Lots of them. 3 chapters worth. This didn't happen before. So then it says, verse 3 again. So Moshe comes and he tells over the people the words of Hashem and all of the laws. And the people say, all that Hashem said we will do, they're referring to, not the 7 Noahide laws and the 3 laws that were taught in Mara. They're referring to Seres HaDibros, the 10 Commandments, and all of the 3 chapters that we just got finished. Vayichtov Moshe, verse 4. Vayichtov Moshe is called Divrei Hashem. And Moshe wrote down all the words of Hashem. What are we referring to? All of these laws that we've just been taught. Moshe wrote them all down to give to the Jewish people to teach them. Now, the Ramban is easier because it's chronologically speaking, it's simpler that way. The laws that are being taught and the laws that are being written down seem to flow more. I don't know what forced Rashi into saying that. We will get to in a few minutes a justification for Rashi. I don't know if it's enough to answer your question as to what he saw that forced it. We'll get there.
Wouldn't it make sense that Rashi kind of did this also to validate the Torah living in a Christian world, where they could come and say, look, your book has incongruence, you know, as opposed to Rambam living in the Muslim world?
I hope not. I would not want to say that either one of them interpreted this based on that.
I don't mean that he did it for them. He did it because he wanted... He did it with an understanding that he believed this is the way it is, as you're saying, knowing that maybe this would be how we would have to explain it when they would come to us and say, look at all this in fallacy with God's law.
Yeah, but once you say your first half of your statement, then I don't need your second half. Once you say that he felt this is the truth as to how it happened...
Then it doesn't matter.
So then it doesn't matter. You can say anything after that. Because he held that was the truth. He interpreted it that way because that's how he felt what happened. So I would certainly not, without real good reason, want to say that their interpretations were colored by that. Now, sometimes that's a reality. And the reason why that's a reality, not because they did it on purpose, but the society and the culture and the world each giant of commentary lived in affects their thinking. That's a reality, and so therefore they might have interpreted, since the Torah has many different ways of being looked at, so depending on where you are standing, I'm sure I've said this many, many times, but I will say it again. What color is this chumash?
Maroonish.
Actually, it looks pretty white to me. Right? So a very simple example, right? Depending on which side you're looking at, depends on what you're going to see. And if I showed it to you something like this, and I said, how tall does this book look? So someone looking at it from my angle would say, well, this is all that I see. I just see it standing straight up like this. And you would see it very different from your angle. I'm being a very simple example to a very complex concept that when something is complex, depending on where you're standing as you view it, you will have an entirely accurate and different perspective of what it is. And you say, I don't understand, how could two people look at the same things and get such different perspectives? We would have, if we were told to describe what we saw, me looking at a book like this, this is what I'm looking at, and you're looking at like this, and we were to draw a picture in words of what we're looking at, you would not even know that we were looking at anything remotely similar. It'd be impossible. Because you're going to explain, you know, it wouldn't look anything similar. So Chazal say the Shivim Panim LaTorah, there's 70 faces to Torah. Torah is complex enough that depending on how you're looking, there are 70 different facets, 70 different ways of looking at it, all true, all accurate. Depending on where you are, you will have a different view. If you're on the first floor looking out of a building, you'll have a very different perspective than if you're on the 80th. You'll see a different city, right? If you're on the 80th floor looking out, you see the city. When you're on the first floor, you just see the building across the street and maybe a cab going by. Totally different. But only because you're on a different level. So it is with our, when there's a dispute amongst the sages in terms of what a halacha is, it's because they're in their spiritual stature standing in different places. Someone who says it's permissible to jump out the window, and someone says it's forbidden to jump out the window, these are such simple examples for a comment. Wouldn't it make sense that if someone's standing on the second floor, they would say, yeah, you're allowed to jump out the window, and someone standing on the 80th floor would say, no, you're not allowed to jump out the window. And us reading it would say, that's bizarre. How come they're not? They're saying they're both. It's the same question was posed to both of them. Somebody walked into both of their offices and said, can I jump out the window, Rabbi? And one of them said, sure. And one of them said, what, are you crazy? Well, it's because they're standing in very different places. And so in the spiritual world, it's true as well. And different generations stand in different spiritual spheres. Different individuals stand in different spiritual spheres. And depending on where we are will depend on our perspective and the way that we pass get halacha. And that's why each generation's rabbis, the sages say, each generation's rabbis, paskins, decides the halacha for their generation. You must go to your rabbi in your day. Because he will see the world you're living in. The rabbi of four generations before saw a different world. And when he decided halacha, he was literally looking at it from a different angle. So we always like to use precedents. We always stand on precedents. But when a rabbi of today says, I just don't understand where he was coming from, I think it should be like this. The rule is, no matter how small that rabbi is and how great that rabbi was, the rule is we go with your rabbi of today. Because that's the way the system works. We always start with precedent. That's all. Our starting point is, well, what did they say? And if it makes sense today, and we still will stand by it, we'll do it. Sometimes we say, I don't get it, but we're still going to go with what they said. But very often it's not that way. Because we just, you know, it's constantly changing. The sages, in fact, say that today we paskin in the famous disputes between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, we always paskin Beis Hillel. Always. When Mashiach comes, we're going to paskin Beis Shammai. Yeah, that's odd. Well, it's odd, but when you think about it, you know, it's going to be a different world on this. We're going to see things from an entirely different perspective. And maybe Beis Shammai had that perspective back then. So whereas we today look at his opinions and we say, that doesn't make sense. I don't get it. I don't understand where he's coming from. Beis Hillel makes a lot of sense. That's why we hold like Beis Hillel. Will come a time where we will understand more. We will have a different perspective. We will suddenly raise a few levels on the elevator. We'll go up. We'll look out the window and we'll say, oh, I didn't realize. I wasn't looking at it from the third floor. So when I looked out the window, that's what I saw. Had I been looking at it from the 10th floor, I would have had a totally different perspective on things. So anyway, why am I going through all of this? What got this started? Oh, so I was saying, you were saying, so different people living in different ages and different generations, it's true that their commentaries reflect that. Not because they're trying to say, well, what happens if a Christian editor would read this? What? And it's just their world was such where they had a perspective on things that may have led to that interpretation, that interpretation. But the types of sages that we continue to study usually were of the stature where they're. It's true. The Torah has 70. It allows for various different perspectives and interpretations and insights into it.
One last thing. The reason I came to that thought was when I learned that Ptolemy. forced 70 rabbis to go to 70 different rooms, and the translation they gave in Greek was catered somewhat to not offend, to hurt the Jewish people.
Right.
At least I heard this from a rabbi.
No, that's true, because they were translating it for the Greeks.
Them.
Here, Rashi and the Ramban are translating it for us. They're translating it for truth. What happened? So I wouldn't want to say, no, there we have records of that. Those 70 sages of Ptolemy's time purposely mistranslated certain things in order to avoid certain problems. But I don't have any reason why I'd want to say that.
Yeah, but they were all alike. They didn't
Correct. That was the miraculous event, that all 70 came to the same conclusions as to what needed to be changed and adjusted and translated in a way that would spare us from further harm. Okay, let's continue on. So we're at Pasuk Hey, verse 5. So we now have, so according to Rashi, this is taking place before the giving of the Torah. Moshe's been told to go up. He teaches the Jewish people the 7 Noahide mitzvahs, the 3 laws that they'd been taught in the place of Marah. They write it all down, all of Torah from the beginning until this point. I'm actually in the middle of verse Dalet. I never completed. But even Mizbeach Tachas Ahar, Moshe then constructs an altar at the bottom of the foot of the mountain, and he sets up 12 different pillars for the 12 tribes of the Jewish people. Verse 5, he then sends the youths of the children of Israel, and they bring up offerings, different types of offerings, elevation offerings, and they slaughter peace offerings, Lashem Purim. Now Rashi points out here that the Na'arim, the youths, were specifically the firstborns, because until the sin of the golden calf, the firstborns had the role of what the priests do today. They were the ones who would offer the sacrifices, and they made a feast. They had peace offerings, they had burnt offerings, they had all sorts of korbanos and of meat. Now, I'm going to jump ahead to something which we read about in a few verses, but since we're not going to get there today, I want to point something out. Rashi comments later. Let me just find the words. I'm not seeing it right now. Rashi says, from this idea that you see here, and the concept that they had all these offerings, peace offerings, that they sat down to eat, as we'll see in the couple psukim, one of the sources that we have for the concept of Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah, as you know, is not a biblical holiday. Simchas Torah is at the end of the holiday of Sukkot, we complete the reading of the Torah, we go through the whole cycle, and we make a whole big deal about it. So at the second day of the last days of Sukkot, of Shmini Atzeres, is designated as Simchas Torah, and it's a whole big celebration. One of the sources for that comes from here, that when you complete, or when you celebrate the Torah, it's done with a joyous celebration. It's done with feasts, it's done with offerings, it's done with joyous celebration, and then this is one of the sources that we have for that concept. But in any case, so 12 altars are set up with 12 pillars. Each one of the tribes, the firstborns from within those tribes come, and they offer up the sacrifices. Vayikach Moshe, verse 6, Pasuk Vav, Vayikach Moshe chatzi hadom, vayosem ba'aganot, takes half of the blood and puts it in a basin. Vachatzi hadom, zorok al hamizbeach. And the other half, he sprinkles, on the Mizbeach. Rashi comments over here. Famous comment. Whenever there's a sprinkling of blood, Rashi says, that comes together with an immersion in a mikvah. Anytime in the Torah, this is the first sprinkling of blood that we've really had, but when we're going to learn about the sacrifices, so many of the sacrifices have sprinklings of blood, and Rashi comments, whenever there's a sprinkling on a person, there's always a immersion in a mikvah which preceded it. So Rashi comments from the sages as follows. The fact that Moshe here took the blood of these offerings, and he put half of it in basins, and then half of it he put on the Mizbeach, And then as we'll see in the next verse, and he took the Sefer HaBris, he took this book of the covenant that they had just written, and he reads it to the Jewish people, and they say, Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma, the famous words here on this book of the covenant that they had written. So Rashi here learns, Mikan Lomdu Avoseinu Shenichnus Avoseinu LeBris, the Jewish people entered into this covenant with Hashem of the giving of the Torah, and the forming themselves as a nation of Hashem, the Mila, Bitvila the Hazaas Daman, with circumcision, with an immersion in a mikvah, and the sprinkling of the blood, which come together with the sacrifice that they brought. And from here the sages derive many of the laws of conversion are derived from this episode of the Jewish people at Har Sinai. Because the sages saw in the sacrifice that was brought, the sprinkling of the blood, the acceptance of the bris, of the covenant with the book that was written, that they converted. That there was a literal conversion, there was an immersion in a mikvah, there was a circumcision for the men, there was a sprinkling of the blood, there was a conversion which took place. And many of the laws of Geiris, of conversion, which we practice until this day, are actually derived from what the Jewish people went through at Har Sinai, all derived from these verses over here of the sprinkling of the blood and that which went along with it. So in the end of verse, continuing on in verse Zion 7, so we have this Sefer HaBris, we have this book. Now again, and on this book, which is read to the Jewish people said, at the end of this verse, the famous phrase, all that Hashem has said, we will do and we will obey. Na'aseh v'nishma. What was just read to them that they said that phrase on? What is the Sefer HaBris, this book of the covenant, that Moshe reads to the Jewish people, and in response to that, the Jewish people say this famous phrase, Na'aseh v'nishma. So Rashi comments, according to Rashi's approach, in Rashi's opinion, has Moshe gone up to Har Sinai yet?
No.
Has he received the Seres HaDibros? No. Have he received the three chapters of the laws? No. What is this Sefer HaBris? What is this book of the covenant that Moshe just reads to the Jewish people, on which they respond, Na'aseh v'nishma? Says Rashi, Sefer HaBris, in the second to last line, in the second column, Mi Bereshis V'ad Matan Torah U'mitzel Shenitztavu V'mara. The same thing that he just wrote down a few verses earlier. Moshe read from Bereshis until Matan Torah, until this point in the historical life of the Jewish people. He read them all of that. He read them the three mitzvahs which they were commanded in Mara, Shabbos, Parah Aduma, Kibbutz Av Eim, Shabbos, honoring one's parents, and the red heifer. And on that, the Jewish people say, all that Hashem will further command us, because they know that Moshe is on his way back up to get some more. But what they've heard so far is all of the stories of their history. They heard from Bereshis. They heard about Avraham Avinu. They heard about Yitzchak. They heard about Yaakov. They heard about the 12 tribes. They heard about going down to Egypt. And they themselves were the ones who came out of Egypt. They heard all of that. They heard a teaser of the laws of Shabbos, of honoring one's parents, of Parah Aduma. And on that they say this famous phrase, whatever Hashem will teach us, we will do. We know. So when you know, the Jewish people said Na'aseh v'nishma without knowing nothing. It wasn't that they didn't know anything. They knew, they had heard from Bereshis until this point. They knew the history. They knew from Adam HaRishon, from Adam. They knew from Avraham. They knew from Yitzhak. They knew from Yaakov. They knew from their forefathers, the heads of the tribes. And they knew a little bit of the laws. They knew Shabbos. They knew about honoring one's parents. They knew about the Parah Aduma. And on that they said, all that Hashem will command us, we will do. In the Ramban's approach, this Sefer HaBris is even more extensive. According to the Ramban, they had the Ten Commandments already at this point. And they have three chapters worth of laws in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. And it's on that the covenant is made. Now that you know what this is about, they make a covenant, and on that the Jewish people say this famous phrase, whatever Hashem asks of us, we will do and we will say. Now, how exactly this fits with our general understanding that they said that without knowing anything, and that when the Medrash which says, Chazal, the sages who say that Hashem went around to all the other nations and asked them if they wanted, and they said, well, what's in it for us? So they were rejecting the Jewish people, said, no, we will do and we will say. They had an advantage of Jewish people. They knew a lot more about what was going on. They were part of a history. They were part of a continuum of, from the beginning of time, through Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. But that is how Rashi and the Ramban learned. This is where this phrase of Na'aseh v'nishma comes in. According to Rashi, the Jewish people said Na'aseh v'nishma before the Aseres HaDibros. This whole chapter was said before. According to the Ramban, this big phrase, this palace of Nazar Nishma, was said after the revelation at Har Sinai, after the commandments of Parshas Mishpatim are given. At that point, they have the Sefer Bris, and they say, Nasa V'nishma.
There's so many questions about that. I mean, just following up on what Elaine was asking. So, when Moshe Rabbeinu was on the mountain for 40 days, he wasn't writing Rashi's. He's already written that.
According to Rashi, yes, that's correct. Now, I don't even see that to be that. That's the least of it. I mean, there's some other questions, but that's, yeah, 100%.
Of all the things that they agreed to, one thing that would bother me would be the red heifer. Because don't we say that the red heifer, all of those laws were in response to the golden...
No, the Mishkan was the tabernacle, but I don't think the red heifer was.
No?
I mean, if you would, then you'd have to disagree with Rashi's understanding of what the three were. It's not clear what the three were. This is Rashi how the three were. I believe the Ramban might disagree on some of them. I don't remember exactly.
Who were the first Rashi or?
I think Rashi. Pretty sure it was Rashi. They were in very different parts of the world. Rashi was in France, and the Ramban was in Spain. Mm-hmm. But the Ramban had Rashi's commentary, and Rashi never saw the Ramban's commentary. All right, I know it's hot. Let's just finish up a little bit more. Verse 8, Pasuk Ches. No, it's pretty hot, yeah. So Moshe then takes this blood which he had gathered from the sacrifices that the firstborns had offered. And he sprinkles the blood on the people. This is the blood of the covenant. This is going to be the blood of the covenant that Hashem has sealed concerning all of these matters. So you have over and over again in the Torah we find a covenant, a bris that's sealed between the Jewish people and Hashem. And here's one of them. Now again, each one of the commentators in their place. According to Rashi, this is being done before Moshe goes up. There's a covenant that's sealed with this blood of the sacrifices being sprinkled on the people, that there's a covenant being made between Hashem and the Jewish people before Moshe goes up. According to the Ramban, this covenant is being sealed after Moshe has come back down and taught a significant amount of Torah to the Jewish people. But nonetheless, there is another covenant that's being sealed here between them. The next verse I'll read, but it really is, it's a whole class unto itself. Vayiru Eis Elokei Yisrael. Verse 9. I skipped the verse. Moshe and Aaron and Nadav Avihu then ascend the mountain as they were told. Vayiru Eis Elokei Yisrael. The Torah then describes that they, the 74 people, the 70 elders, Moshe, Aaron, and the two sons of Aaron, perceive Hashem himself. V'tachas raglav, and underneath Hashem's feet, so to speak, kima ase livnat hasapir, was a sapphire brickwork, as if he was standing on some bricks that were made of a precious stone. Uche etzem hashamayim latoyar, and it was like the essence of the heaven in purity. So there's an image that's seen, where Hashem is, so to speak, standing on top of precious stone brick, and it was bright, like the essence of heaven in purity. Guesses what that means? Okay, me either. Rashi actually comments a fascinating... There's a huge discussion. I'm going to leave it blank. It's one of those that very often you have a verse thrown in that's like, whoa, what am I supposed to do with that? So I'm going to leave that as one of those, but I do want to make one comment. Rashi comments over here that the idea of the brickwork underneath Hashem's feet, so to speak, Rashi says a beautiful idea. This was always in front of Hashem, so to speak, during the time of servitude of the Jewish people. Lizkort sarason shel Yisrael. As a reminder, so to speak, of the pain and suffering of the Jewish people. They were in servitude with bricks, So Hashem, so to speak, had a red string around his finger. He was standing his platform, so to speak, as if you could talk this way, whatever this means, upon which he would stand was sapphire brickwork. As a reminder, again, there's always as if. We don't. God doesn't need reminders in this heart to even speak this way, but there's an idea that when the Jewish people were in suffering, so Hashem, so to speak, had his throne of glory was now made out of bricks, because the Jewish people were suffering with bricks, and there was sort of that, my Jewish people are in suffering, so I have this as well. Kind of, you know, another Jew's in suffering, we do things that, like, what does that help them? Whatever, they're in suffering, I'm going to suffer also. I'm going to sleep on the floor because someone's house burnt down. That's just what I do. There's much more to that. I'm not getting into it now. I'm just letting you know that it is there. And then the verse just concludes that against the great men of the children of Israel, he did not stretch out his hand. They gazed at God, yet they ate and drank. And there's too much. We're out of time. These last two verses are packed. These last two verses are packed. Yeah. I always try to plan just whenever I get stuck, you just say, oh, we're out of time. All right, but anyway, that's a major dispute between Rashi and the Rabban, how to understand these verses. So there's major significance. Here's the famous verse of Naaseh v'Nishma, we'll do and we will say, what was written down before they went up to the mountain. But you have here, according to Rashi, for sure, from Bereishis until Matan Torah was written separately. And then Moshe goes up to get the Torah. And according to the Rabban, the order happened in the opposite direction. That's pretty interesting. All right, but that's a wrap.